Accession number 8737, rule number 1.
Group Captain Griffiths, Reel 1. Where were you born, Group Captain Griffiths?
I was born at Darlaston, just on the outskirts of Birmingham.
Which year was that?
1918. The 14th of May, 1918.
What did your father do for a living?
Oh, at that time he was, a cashier at a steel firm.
And where were you educated?
I was educated at Llandrin of Wells County School.
And how old were you when you left?
About 16, I think it was.
To do what?
Well, my parents had a business, a grocery business. It was intended that I would go and work in the grocery business.
So how did you come to be in the RAF?
Well, I had an uncle who was in the Flying Corps, and I was so taken with the diaries and the various memorabilia that we had of him, and it was my great desire to join the RAF and to fly from reading these diaries and things.
Did the great casualty rate of the Royal Flying Corps not put you off?
Oh, no, not at all. It wasn't a thing I even considered at all.
How did you go about joining the RAF?
Well, I wrote to the Air Ministry, and eventually I managed to get an interview, and this was in 1937.
Was it easy to get in?
No, it wasn't. In actual fact, that I arrived there and I carried out this interview, and because I'd left school before I'd got the school leaving certificate, they said that my education standard wasn't high enough, and that if I had cared to bring it up to the required school leaving certificate standard, that then I could join.
How did you bring it up to standard?
Well, I then went to a crammer for about 6 months, and I got him to sign a piece of paper to say that I was up to the standard of the school leaving certificate.
And then was it
And then I reapplied.
And it was straightforward then?
Straightforward, yes. I had my medical and I got in.
Did you go into the RAF with the idea of flying?
Oh, yes, yes. Oh, previously I'd had brochures and things trying to convince me that the that there was still a career in the non-flying side, but I just wasn't interested. I was only interested in flying and nothing else.
Now, can we go on to the outbreak of war, and can you tell me what your reaction was when you heard that war had been declared with Germany?
Well, it was extremely exciting. Again, I think that the build-up of the Air Force at that time, we'd gone from dropping practice bombs to dropping live bombs, and I think that in this gradual feeling that war was going to come, and when it came, it was almost a relief in some ways. And I thought exciting.
Did you come across anybody who was opposed to the war declaration?
None at all, no. I think that we're all, as I say, it seemed to be an exciting time.
What did you think about the RAF's chances at that time against the Luftwaffe?
I don't think we even thought about it. I think we thought that we were well-trained. I think we had certain doubts about the type of aircraft that we were flying. But again, I thought that our training and our ability would get us through. I don't think it ever entered our head that we were inferior in any way.
What was the nature of your doubts about the aircraft?
Well, I was at that time flying ferry battles, and it really was an extremely well-constructed aircraft, but we thought badly armed and had insufficient power. It was far too heavy for the engine that it was driving it at that time.
Did you speak about these doubts, or did you keep your doubts to yourself?
Not really, no. I was immediately... Although I was in an operational squadron at that time, the squadron was divided. Half of it was sent to France to reinforce another squadron, and the other half was kept at home to act as an operational conversion unit. And I was one of those selected to stay and help run this operational conversion unit. And it never entered my head, and I don't think any of our heads at that time, to think that of complaining about this aircraft. I think it was realized by the powers that it wasn't really a highly suitable aircraft for the war.
Did you fly the ferry battle in combat?
No, I didn't. No.
Now, can you tell me how you came to be involved in special operations?
Well, at 150 Squadron, which was based at Snaith at that time, was due to be converted onto the Liberator aircraft. And I was one of the people selected to be converted initially, and had been converted onto this aircraft, and then it was decided that it would be better to convert the people onto Liberators by setting up a Liberator conversion unit. And this was done at Polbrook. And then we'd only been established as a Liberator conversion unit for a short time when we received an urgent message that two of the aircraft had to be flown immediately to the Middle East. The only two crews that were really in a state at that time to fly these aircraft out was one, myself, and another person called Rolf Smith. So the two of us, together with crews, flew to Herne and then out to the Middle East. We had to fly, because of the war in Europe at that time, out to a point of 6 degrees west, across the Pyrenees, and down the center of the Mediterranean, coming in at roughly between Tobruk and Alamein. The reason that we had to take this particular route out was because of the Rommel push in the North African desert, which was gradually coming towards Egypt. We landed at a base called Cairo West, and it was from there that we learned that our base was going to be at Fayed. It wasn't until we got to Fayed that we realized that we were going to be carrying out special operations in Yugoslavia.
What was the date that we're speaking of now?
We actually flew out to the Middle East on the 10th of March 1942.
What was the setup at the base at Fayed?
It wasn't particularly sophisticated, actually. We realized that when we arrived there that we weren't treated with any great enthusiasm because, and quite naturally, I think that the headquarters in the Middle East were more anxious to have aircraft that were capable of bombing Rommel rather than supplying the partisans in the Yugoslavia. The squadron at Fayed was also being converted onto Liberators, so it was decided that the two aircraft that they were using on that squadron for conversion would be handed over to the special operations flight, and also a Wellington.
Can you recollect anything that was said to you about which indicated the lack of enthusiasm for special operations?
No, I can't, really. No. It was just a feeling I had.
On the part of whom, in particular?
Well, I really can't be more specific than that, really. It was, one had this feeling. And we were on a station that was had other Wellington squadrons that were operating in the Western Desert. And the flight officers and the aircraft maintenance facilities that we had were pretty basic and not as sophisticated as any of the other squadrons that were operating from Fayyan.
In what way were they basic?
Well, all our maintenance had to be done completely out of doors, where with the Wellington squadrons, they used to bring them into the hangar for some of the major servicing.
Can you remember how it was put to you that you were going to do these operations?
No, I can't really, no. I just can't remember.
What was your reaction when you heard that you were going to do it?
Oh, very exciting. I was, I had been previously on operations in Germany where I'd been bombing, in a bombing role, and to drop agents and supplies I thought was very exciting, and particularly in an area which was really foreign to any other aircraft. There had no other operations, as far as I know, had been carried out in the Yugoslavian area.
Was, when you were told that you were going to do these operations, was it put to you what the main problems were going to be for you?
Oh yes, they were fairly fundamental, really, because we realized that we were going to operate in extremely mountainous areas, and we knew that the orders that were going to emanate would be from the partisans themselves, who we realized probably weren't au fait with the type of dropping zones that would be ideal for our operations. They were based in the mountains, and naturally that the supplies that they wanted would have to be dropped near to where they were operating, and suitable plateaus would have to be found on which we could drop these agents and the supplies. And also that we had to drop the supplies and agents on a pattern of lights. And it was sometimes quite difficult to pick out these patterns of light in weather conditions that weren't entirely suitable at times.
What did you know about climatic conditions of Yugoslavia?
Very little. And this was another great problem we had, really. It was difficult for us to get up-to-date weather information to such a degree that they eventually established us with a Lysander, which we had to fly to Heliopolis, which was the base for the meteorological office, get the latest weather information from then and fly back to Fayyad, our base, and more or less brief ourselves on the type of weather that we could expect. Well, it was a very basic information that was received in that area. How they got the information, I don't know on weather. It was just presumably based on information from surrounding countries.
Once you got going, what did you find were the main problems with weather over Yugoslavia?
Oh, electrical storms are extremely bad there. On one such occasion, I remember we were flying flying up to Yugoslavia, and the weather was such that we had St. Elmo's fire, which really gave the aircraft a most ghost-like appearance against the clouds of this rather flame going through the air. It was rather a frightening situation. And the turbulence was such, as I remember on one occasion, the aircraft was turned completely round in the opposite direction to which we wanted to go.
Can you describe what St. Elmo's fire is, precisely?
Well, it seems that you get little flickers of light and fire that goes from propeller tip to propeller tip, which gives the effect of each propeller being a kind of a Catherine wheel. And you also get little flames of electricity darting from the control column and to other metal parts of the aircraft. It's quite an alarming and yet in many ways a beautiful thing.
Is it dangerous in any way?
No. It's not as dangerous being struck by lightning, no.
What about the enemy opposition over the Balkans?
The enemy opposition, really, was basically on the island of Rhodes. We used to have to cross over Rhodes, both on the way there and on the way back from operations. And because of the length of time of the journey, we couldn't really escape flying over Rhodes at early evening and early morning, so that we had to fly there in a kind of a dusk-dawn period of time. And there were fighters based there. We didn't have any serious encounter with the forces. But it was always in the back of our mind that that was going to be a problem. So on most occasions we really veered over to fly over the Turkish coast, and this in some ways was a bit worrying because Turkey at that time, of course, was neutral.
Was it technically an infringement of neutrality?
Technically, I suppose so. Yes, I did mention this to the headquarters at Ismailia, but they shrugged it off as not being an important factor.
Did you see any Turkish planes?
No.
Presumably you would have preferred to go over roads at night, would you?
Oh, yes, during the hours of darkness, yes, certainly.
And were there no German fighters to be considered elsewhere?
No, there was no, we had no problems at all on any other parts of the journey or in dropping zones.
What about flak? Was that a problem?
No, never encountered it at all.
Can you say something about the character of the Liberator as an aircraft to fly?
Yes, it was a delightful aircraft to fly. It was a real pilot's aircraft. I liked flying it very much indeed, and it was extremely reliable. The problems, I suppose, were the fact that it was an untried operational aircraft. We didn't know, and I don't think anyone at that time had experience on how it would stand up to probably a fighter attack or a severe hit from an anti-aircraft. The self-sealing tanks were also a little dubious. They had not been tried out in war. The other thing was that it had quite a sophisticated electrical operated bomb doors. They acted in the form of a roller-top desk. The bomb doors used to roll back up into the fuselage. And on many of the operations, we had trouble in opening these doors fully. And unless they opened fully, the remaining electrical contacts wouldn't work. So you couldn't prime your dropping canisters if the bomb doors didn't open fully. It had, of course, an excellent endurance. It had something like 19 hours endurance. So it was very satisfying from the fact that if we ever came back and found inclement weather back at the base, we still had sufficient fuel to probably be diverted to bases in Palestine. So that was a very reassuring fact of the aircraft. So all in all, it was an excellent pilot's aircraft, but in some ways, being an untried aircraft, it didn't fully act as a good operational aircraft.
Did you ever have to go to Palestine in an emergency?
Yes, we did. When Rommel finally came to Alamein, it was necessary for certain aircraft to be diverted to or based in the rear. And the Liberator, with this excellent endurance, was the one that was selected to go to Palestine. And some of the forward-based aircraft being brought back to the canal zone. So for a period of 2 or 3 months, we were based at St. Jean's in Palestine.
Where's that?
It's near Haifa.
J-E-A-N-S?
J-E-A-N-S, yes.
What about the capacity of the Liberator?
Oh dear, I can't really remember.
Not in figures, but...
No, it carried... I know we carried, I think it was 4 big canisters, which were used for dropping supplies in... by supplies, I mean arms, and also such things as gold sovereigns, which, of course, was the currency that was available for the partisans to use to bribe Italians or Germans or whatsoever.
Was strict security kept over the sovereign?
Very much so, yes. We didn't know an awful lot of what was carried in the canisters. We knew that there were arms, and we knew there were sovereigns, and we knew that there were other supplies, medical supplies. But this was done, the actual packing and loading was done by the army.
And so what would the appearance of the load be to you as you entered the aircraft?
It would be 4 big cylindrical packing cases. And, of course, they had parachutes attached to them.
Wooden packing cases?
No, metal. Metal.
Now, I think you also dropped agents to the partisans.
Oh, yes, indeed. Yes. I can't remember the exact number, but we certainly dropped agents initially to Mihalovich, but then at a certain stage in the war, it was decided that probably Tito was a better bet than Mihalovich, and that we then started dropping to Tito. On one occasion, we did a trip where we had agents for both Tito and Mihalovich. One was carried in the front of the aircraft, and the others were carried in the rear of the aircraft, and we were told that they were not to meet at all. So we went to one dropping zone and dropped the one lot of agents, and then went to another zone to drop another lot of agents.
Did each group of agents know of the presence of the other?
No. We were told that they mustn't meet. It was a little tricky, I must admit, that when one of them wanted to spend a penny, we had to take one from one end of the aircraft and bring them up to the flight deck so the others could go back to the rear and spend a penny.
Were the agents British?
No. Except on the Greek, when we dropped them to blow up a viaduct in Greece, they were a mixture of British and New Zealanders and one or two Greek wireless operators. But the ones in Yugoslavia were all Yugoslavs.
Did you see much of the agents before they were dropped?
No. They only arrived at the airfield probably as we were more or less going out to the aircraft to take off. They were matters of 10 minutes before we took off. The agent was brought to the aircraft.
What was their demeanor? Could you tell?
I greatly admired them, really. They seemed to be extremely keen to drop back into their own country, and I had a certain admiration. I had a lot of admiration for them, really. They seemed quite a tough bunch of characters.
How did they show their keenness?
Keenness that, whenever we failed to carry out an operation and had to bring them back, they seemed very despondent, and in many ways they were quite done. But they'd come back, and the next time we took them, they'd be extremely keen and excited.
And what equipment would they be carrying with them?
Well, they liked the particular weapon that they carried, personal arms, personal weapons, and they took a preference to the weapon that they'd been used during training. Although it was the idea that they would drop with the weapon of the enemy, in other words, so that they could steal ammunition or buy ammunition locally from anyone who cared to steal it. Like Lugers and Berettas, they often would prefer the arms that they were trained with, like a Lee Enfield or some such weapon as that.
Did they have a lot of equipment or minimal?
No, minimal equipment.
Did they ever have radios?
I think there were radios in the packs that would drop with them, in the containers that would drop with them. Because it was by radio, of course, which was the main communications between the partisans and, of course, London.